Psalm 39 today. I really enjoy the worship we already shared. Very personal, kind of intimate recognition of God in our lives. And Psalm 139 carries that on for us. And we've lifted a phrase out of it as our title for this morning, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. And we'll highlight that when we get there, but there's a lot more going on in this psalm. It's probably not one of the best-known psalms, but you'll probably hear bits and pieces in there. You'll go, oh, I've heard that before. I never knew where that came from. So let's start by just reading through it together. Psalm 139, the sort of subtitle for the choir director, a psalm of David. And then verse 1. O Lord, you've examined my heart and know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts, even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. For such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you're there. If I go down to the grave, you are there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the farthest oceans, even there your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness I cannot hide from you. To you the night shines as bright as day. Darkness and light are the same to you. You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. How precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of the sand. And when I wake up, you are still there. O God, if only you would destroy the wicked. Get out of my life, you murderers. They blaspheme you. Your enemies misuse your name. O Lord, shouldn't I hate those who hate you? Shouldn't I despise those who oppose you? Yes, I hate them with total hatred, for your enemies are my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you, and lead me along the path of everlasting life. Psalm 139. It's wonderful poetry, beautiful imagery, and teaches us so much about God. First phrase for the choir director, that's kind of interesting. Even though it seems like a very personal kind of prayer, very kind of intimate thing, the writer meant it to be sung by a choir for all to hear. I kind of like that. Second thing we're told, it's the Psalm of David. King David wrote this. David's an amazing character. He's one of those guys you read about and you think it would take, you know, three lifetimes to fit in everything that he experienced, but it was just one life. He begins life as the youngest son of a rural family. Farmers, most people were then. And he was sent out into the fields to take care of the sheep and would be gone for days, maybe a week or two, they would hardly notice that he was missing. He would just be out there taking care of the sheep. One day, the great prophet Samuel comes to their little town of Bethlehem and says he's looking for the next king of Israel. David's dad shows him all the sons, forgetting David, who was out in the field. And Samuel says, these are great boys, but they're not the right boy. And Jesse says, well, there is one more. And David walks in and Samuel says, that's the one. So what do you do when this amazing thing happens to you? When the great prophet comes to your home and selects you to be the next king of Israel, what do? You go back and take care of the sheep for a while. So he does. A while later, his brothers are off fighting in the war, and dad calls him down from the hills and says, here's some food and supplies, take these to your brothers, and so he does. And you know the story, when he gets there, he sees the two armies separated by a valley, and that army, the Philistines, has this big, angry, ugly guy yelling at them, and David says, you can't talk to my God like that. So David becomes this rock star. He becomes a great military leader. And he's famous and he's loved and by everybody except the king. And he's part of the court. He's best friends with the king's eldest son, who should be the next king, and he ends up marrying the king's daughter. I mean, but every now and then the king tries to kill him. So those difficult family discussions again, right? I want to kill your husband. Do you mind? So he runs and hides, and sometimes he's back in the court, and he's, you know, he's cool, and he's there, and then sometimes he's off hiding in a cave. It's a hard life. It's a strange employment circumstance, you know. There's some stress factors there involved, I think. He walks that tightrope for a while, but he will not betray the king. Even though he's been anointed to be the next king, he will do nothing to harm the king. Finally, Saul's killed in battle. David is crowned, finally accepts the crown and unites the kingdom, goes on to live another amazing life with doing amazing things and making some amazing mistakes. But one of the things about David is that he never hides it. He learns from the situation and he's brutally honest with God, and all of these thoughts he writes down and he says, here, sing about this. And he hands it to the priests. He's got this amazing openness. He's the first politician to have a Twitter account and just to put stuff out there. This is how I think today. This is what I'm feeling today. And I want you all to know about it. I want you to sing it out loud. Psalm 139 is the result of that. This amazing man who seemed like so many people tie into one, and yet he really, really, really just wants to be closer to God. Ultimately, that's what it all comes down to. And this psalm takes us there. It's a wonderful little piece. I mean, if nothing else, it's a great little poem, a great little piece of literature, broken into four stanzas. And each of those stanzas, David sort of sees God in a different way, but in a closer way. And he invites us to go there with him. So let's start breaking it down. We're just going to kind of walk through the whole psalm this morning. One of the things about the psalm, too, is it's very broad. It just paints this huge picture of God, but it does so in little statements that at different times in history, those little statements might become more important than others. So we're going to highlight some of the things that David wrote that maybe to him was just meh, but to us maybe, whoa. Anyway, we'll highlight some of that. First stanza, the first six verses. Lord, you've examined my heart. You know everything about me. You know when I sit down, when I stand up. You know my thoughts, even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel, when I rest at home. You know everything I do. It starts with this idea that God is interactive. David's understanding of God is he doesn't have to go find God. He doesn't have to go hunt God down. He doesn't have to go find the right temple for God. God is examining David. There's an interaction, and God starts it. God is interested in David. Oh, Lord, you have examined my heart. You know everything about me. This God that David knows is everywhere. Omnipresent is the fancy word we use for that. He's not just in the temple, and when you're in the temple, you better impress him, but when you're out of the temple, you can do whatever you want. Very common for, you know, the kinds of idols and temples in David's day. Very common understanding that each country had their own gods, and so when you're in this country, you worship that god. When you go to that country, you worship that god. It was just common knowledge at the time. But the God that David sees, the God that David knows, is above all that. There's nowhere that David can go. Interesting phrase. You know when I sit down or stand up, you know my thoughts even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. That phrase is really interesting. When I travel, when I rest at home, when I go out, when I lie down. It really presents a contrast because the going out is public. When everybody else sees me, God sees me too. But when I lie down, they have the idea of, you know, tucking into bed. And we understand that the phrase even talks about, you know, can refer to marital intimacy. It's that time in your life when no one else knows you. But God does. So if you're in front of a crowd of 10,000, God is one of those who's with you. And if you're all alone, God is with you. Public and private, it's the same to him. It's the same to him. So that's good news. It's good news. It can be challenging. And I think this is one of those points that maybe jumps out at us in our time, because it's very easy with technology bringing us to the world that we're in, we can live such splintered lives. Even in a relatively small city like Campbell River, imagine living in the middle of Tokyo or something. It's easy to travel for an hour to get to work, to see people there that you will never see anywhere else. You're part of that community and you have that role. And then you travel here and you're part of another community, you have that role. You're on a hockey team or you play basketball or something. And then you travel another and here's this community, that happens to be your family, and you have a certain role in the family. And it's very easy for us to feel like we are so many different people at once. And I'm not, don't worry, I'm not talking about hypocrisy. That's a very shallow kind of thing to discuss, because it goes a lot deeper than that. We find very often that we are expected to be a 100% employee. And then I go home and be a 100% parent, and then I go out and I be a 100% athlete. And we find ourselves giving in so many different directions, and yet often feeling like we're not really being supported ourselves. It's so easy. It's so easy to be tempted to just, well, what if I do this in this community where nobody else knows? I can do that at work and it won't affect anybody else. I can act like this when I'm out with the boys and it won't affect anything else. When I'm online, I have that whole online community, people I may never see in my entire life. I can do something online that no one else needs to know. And it's just very easy for us to feel like, since we're giving so much, that we're sort of invested in different worlds and we're splintered. You can read the counselors and the psychologists that talk about how people deal with this and how it strains people. The good news is there is one person who is in all of your communities. You're God. When you're at work, when you're at home, when you're playing hockey, when you're online, when you're standing in front of a crowd, or when you're just breathing alone somewhere. The one thing that unites every aspect of your life is you're God. You are one person. You have a safety net. There is someone who knows that maybe you're having a bad day at work today because of all the things you're dealing with at home. Or maybe there's things at home that didn't get fixed, or things you didn't do with the kids because you've got this massive project at work. God knows that. He understands the whole balance. He is in your life. You are in him. Relax. Take a breath, David. Because God knows you better than all of those communities that you're involved in. And the truth is, God is usually far more forgiving than all of those communities that you're involved in. So relax and be God's child first. He knows you and he likes you. He doesn't expect much from you. So when you go there and when you go there and when you do this and when you do that, be with God. Just relax and know that God is with you. Can't escape him. You wouldn't want to, but even if you did, you couldn't escape him. When he's a poet or a warrior, when he's a politician, when he's a father, when he's a king, David is always God's first. That's how he knows himself. That's how he sees himself. We see this reflected in a few places in the New Testament. In Acts, Paul is having a discussion with some Greek philosophers, you know, some smart guys. And Paul was one of those guys who had read, had studied what some of the other people believed. And he could talk to them quite freely. And he says this thing in Acts 17, talking about God. He says, his purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, though he's not far from any of us. For in him we live and move and exist. Like some of the older translations, in him we live and move and have our being. Now, have our being is not a phrase we would normally use, but it's a nice poetic phrase. In him we live and move and exist, as some of your poets have said. We are his offspring. And since this is true, we shouldn't think of God as an idol designed by craftsmen from gold or silver or stone. We shouldn't think of God as an elementary school teacher who's just looking for us to do something wrong. No offense to elementary school teachers, but that's how the kids feel. I'm not saying the teachers are like that. No, it's good news. He's with us. He likes us. He wants to be part of our lives. That's good news. So he's the God of my daily life. From that, David goes on to the next stanza. Once he's convinced that God is the God of the physical world. Oh, wait a minute. There was another quote there, wasn't there? Thank you. Hebrews 4:13. Let's look at that one. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God. Everything is naked and exposed before his eyes. He is the one to whom we are accountable. Again, that's good news. I mean, it can be bad news if you're a terrible person, but that's not the point. This is written to support you, to strengthen you, to encourage you. You are in God's world. Let that be your foundation. So God is the God of our daily life in this first stanza. David then goes on in the second stanza, starting in verse 7, to point out that God is the God of our spiritual life. I can never escape from your spirit. Okay, we've already said that, physically, you can't go here or there. It doesn't matter if you're at the mall or the office, God's with you. Now David goes a step farther. I can't escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you're there. If I go down to the grave, you're there. If I ride the wind, oh man, it's beyond the physical. That's good news. Yeah, I remember used to do kind of street outreach and that kind of stuff. And talk to people, you get some really interesting ideas about what people think of the spirit world in the afterlife. You start saying, well, this is what I think. What do you think? I think if you're a good person, if you have positive thoughts and you have positive things to say, then when you die, you'll be in a positive place. Lots of variations of that. And I like that idea, but I don't have that power. I don't have the power to change my height or my eye color. I can't grow more teeth if I want to. There's no way I can say, yes, I am going to define my eternity. I know. Of all the things that we humans admit that we fail at, still sometimes we think, yes, but I'm going to control the spirit world around. No, I don't think so. I'm going to create my own afterlife. There's something else, though, in this section that David points out that I think it's good for us to keep in mind. There's only one spirit world. There's only one. It's a common idea in our comic strips and in cartoons and movies that heaven and hell are kind of two separate spheres, and that heaven is where God's in charge and hell is where Satan's in charge. Heaven, God sits on a throne, and in hell, Satan sits on a throne. In heaven, God chooses what's going to happen to you, and in hell, Satan chooses what's going to happen to you. There's nothing in the Bible. I mean, that's funny, right? I love far-side cartoons. There are some great ones. But the Bible doesn't give any hint that that's the way it is. The Bible talks about one spirit world and one God and one throne. God is on the throne. In hell, Satan is just a prisoner. Nothing more. He won't control anybody else's experience in hell. The Bible leaves no question. There's one throne. Philippians 2, 9 to 11 says, therefore, God elevated him, talking about Jesus, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all names, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue declare that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. There's nowhere where Jesus will not be honored, recognized, worshiped. The idea that, if I'm with Christians, then I'm the Holy Spirit, the Christian spirit, but then I go over here and there's a different spirit. No. I mean, there are other active spirits on the planet who do not obey God, but God is the God of all, the master of all, the Lord of lords, the King of kings, the only ruler, and he rules everywhere. And, you hear some people jokingly, I hope only, saying things, the stubborn people saying, well, I'm not going to bow down to God. I'd rather go to hell than bow down to Jesus. Well, those two things are mutually exclusive. And bowing to Jesus in the end will not be something that they have to hold a spear at our backs to. Not like the scene in Esther where they're forcing people to bow. Bowing to our God, bowing to our Creator is simply going to be as natural as breathing is to us now. He is who He is. Therefore, and it won't matter if we are in a blessed place of intimacy with God in heaven or in a shameful place of separateness in hell. God is God. Jesus is on the throne. All will recognize that. All will worship Him. Doesn't mean they'll enjoy worshiping Him, but they will know who He is. There'll be no question. You don't choose which kingdom in the afterworld you go to. There's only one. You just choose how close to God you get to be. If I go to heaven, if I go to hell, you're there. It's the Spirit of God everywhere. He is supreme. So David originally talks about the God of daily life and the God of spiritual world. He takes it one step closer to God, one step farther along the road, and he looks at the source of the physical and spiritual world. Not just that God is throughout the physical world and that God is throughout the spiritual world, but God is actually the source of the physical and spiritual world. You made all the delicate inner parts of my body, knit me together in my mother's womb. And he goes on to talk about the really difficult stuff. Remember, David didn't have a really good website that showed the organs and how things, I mean, there was just a general idea back then of how things worked in there. And the main thing was you don't want any of it to fall out. That's the main thing. You know, especially for a general on the battlefield, that's bad. We don't want our soldiers popping. We if we keep it all together, we got a better chance of winning this battle. So David's not coming at this from a Encyclopedia Britannica kind of thing. He just knows that there's so much stuff that's so important, and where did it all come from? God. In fact, God was part of the making of it. Actively, you watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. I love that. Couldn't hide anywhere from God, not even before David could think. Not even before David. You know, David was smaller than could be seen by a human eye, and yet God was involved in knitting him together. That's another thing, this statement that I think jumps out at us, and that's why we've chosen that as the title, that we're fearfully and wonderfully made. Because for the last few hundred years, there have been a lot of people that have tried to look at the entire universe as we know it and say, yeah, I'm pretty sure that just happened by accident. That there is no creator. Everything exists just because it exists. There was no idea behind it, no design, no intention. And we've come through that. We've lived through that, our grandparents and our parents especially. Now, I love science. I do. I like science. I'm not that great at it. I didn't take a lot of science because it involved homework. And I was allergic to that as a teenager. So I did drama and sports. Got me where I am today. I love science. But I want science to be honest with me. I think science needs to live up to its own standards. And the standards of science are actually pretty, pretty stiff. And yet those standards get to be sort of tripped up when it comes to this issue of how did the universe come to be. If you hear a scientist make a statement like 2.5 billion years ago, this happened, that's not science. That's faith. There's no scientific method that can give us assurance about what happened 2.5 billion years ago. A good scientific statement would be, according to some theories, 2.5 billion years ago. Okay, now I'll listen to that. Okay, according to some theories. A better scientific statement would be, according to some theories, 2.5 billion years ago, and then other theories say, okay, that's the scientist I want to listen to. He's being honest and he's being open and he's not just trying to convince me of something. 2.5 million years ago, dinosaurs roamed the earth. No. But according to some theories, okay, now I will listen. How do we know? Well, we found their bones in rocks that are 2 million years old. Well, how do we know those rocks are 2 million years old? They got dinosaur bones in them. And again, I'm not trying to mock scientists or science, but sometimes it gets to be that silly. We believe it because we believe it. Again, that's not science living up to its own standards. And again, I'm not an expert, but I really think that most people that try to use science to prove there was no creator, they fall into two very dangerous mistakes. One of them is that they've already decided what the answer cannot be before they approach the problem. They've already decided no matter how much they discover, the answer can never be that it was created, that there was intention, that there was design. We're just not going to find that. Imagine a child, a brilliant girl, and she grows up and she's a wonderful mathematician, but she from a very early age was taught very specifically the number 4 just doesn't exist. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, a whole new Sesame Street happening there. It's great. She can do a lot of really important stuff, but every now and then she's going to come along with a problem and say, wow, this is hard. I think the answer is somewhere between 3.999 and 5, somewhere in that area. We're not sure. We just need a little more funding, a little more research. You can't decide when you try to understand the universe that, okay, I will decide that I'm not going to find a creator behind it. Science can't do that. You can't eliminate certain answers. The other thing you can't do is ignore data that brings your discoveries into question. That's the second mistake that is very easy to make as a scientist. That if someone else makes a discovery that sort of shames your discovery, what do you do about that? So we have evidence from various sources that dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time. No, we don't look at that. We won't study that. We won't include that in our dialogue because it doesn't support what we've already decided. There are some who say they've actually found flesh on dinosaur bones, soft tissue. Interesting. I think most of the field in that area would say, no, that can't exist. It's either been, it's coming from somewhere else, it's contaminated your research. We just can't accept that as a possible explanation because it doesn't fit into our theory. That's bad science. So be careful. And the other thing is that there's money to be made. There's money to be made. When Encyclopedia Britannica writes a bold statement, you read something on the National Geographic website, wow. But you talk to science about that and they'll say, well, that's a theory. So we do need to be careful. And we don't need to be angry. We just need to recognize where the world is at that we live in. To study creation, to see the balance of elements and forces, to consider the minute details of reproduction, to determine how many interactive parts there must be, just so you can see everything going on between here and here, so that I know you're there. To understand that, to be awed at that, and yet to say, well, there's obviously no intention or design, it's very, very difficult and dangerous. God's a creator. Now, I know that for the last many generations, last few hundred years, in a sense, the church was far behind the world in trying to understand this stuff, right? And so for a long time, it was very typical for Christians, when they go to university, leave your Bible at home. When you go to church, you leave your brain at home. There was that idea, and I'm not trying to mock anybody because I admire the people that hung on to their faith through those really difficult times when it seems like they had no answers for these very wise and well-trained people out there. But you know what? We're through that. We have just communities of well-trained, smart men and women who are studying the sciences, who are leading in their fields. and they believe in God. They have a saving life, a saving faith in Jesus Christ. They take the Bible very seriously, and they're doing amazing work. And they're asking questions that other people might not be able to ask. They're willing to be laughed at a bit by stating the obvious. They're willing to say, that emperor is kind of buck naked up there. If you remember that story. If you don't remember the story, ignore what I just said. There are great people there, great scientists that we can trust. Always read through it. But it's the kind of thing we can say with confidence that in our day and age now, you can go home after church, look up some good websites, read some good articles, and before supper tonight, you can have a renewed appreciation for your Creator because of the work of some very great, faithful people over the last few generations. Man, I feel so fortunate. 100 years ago, we were shaking in our boots in some ways. We don't have to do that anymore. We can be confident that to say that I was fearfully, wonderfully made is not an embarrassing statement, and it's not unscientific. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful statement. And it's important. It's important for our faith throughout Scripture. Let's just look at a couple of quick verses. Ecclesiastes 12, 1. Don't let the excitement of your youth cause you to forget your Creator. Honor him with your youth before you grow old and say, life is not pleasant anymore. I love that little part. Isaiah the great prophet, then at last the people will look to their Creator and turn their eyes to the Holy One of Israel. Isaiah, he says again later on in verse 40, have you never heard, have you never understood? The Lord is the everlasting God, the Creator of all the earth. He never grows weak or weary. No one can measure the depths of his understanding. Jeremiah came along a little bit later and he said, but the God of Israel is no idol. He is the Creator of everything that exists, including Israel, his own special possession, the Lord of heaven's armies. Is his name. And then after people understood Jesus through his death and resurrection, they continued to say things like this, what Paul wrote in Romans, talking about the nations that had turned from God. He said, they traded the truth about God for a lie, so they worshiped and served the things God created instead of the Creator himself. And he's talking about the Greek world and the Roman world for that. And then to the people in Colossians, he says, Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. And in case you're worried about that before thing, let's look at what he says two verses later in 17. He existed before everything else and he holds all creation together. I love the image of him holding all creation together because it's the same image David had that the hands of God were knitting him together in the womb, that God was participating in his birth. And that's wonderful. And we need to be so grateful for God for teaching us that, but not just so that we can prove other people wrong. We don't need to criticize science or scientists or prove other people wrong. That's not the message. That's never the message. We're not going to make people feel closer to God by convincing them that what they know is wrong. What people need to know is that they were chosen. That there was a wonderful being who chose their height and their shape and the color of their eyes because he wanted that for them because he likes them. And he cares about them. And he was involved in their life intimately even before they were born. They have a Creator who loves them, a Father who cares, who knows them and loves them just the way he made them. That's the message that we need to know. That was the message that this brutal warrior David comes to as he's discovering this whole thing. He says, you know what? When it all comes together, this is who I am. I'm just this little speck that God designed and knit together. That's good news for people who have been taught sometimes that they are equal in value to snail snot. You're just biology. You're just an accident. And someday the whole universe will collapse and start over and we're nothing. Oh no, you're everything. You're intentional. You were designed, you were wanted, and you were made according to God's design. He looks at you and he goes, wow, I made that. Just the way she is, just the way he is. Puts his signature on us and says, they're mine. they're mine. And an amazing part about that the New Testament takes us even further. Your physical body is God's, but it's not even just a physical body. Because when you become a follower of Jesus, we read this in Corinthians. Your body then becomes the temple of the Holy Spirit. And he lives in you and was given to you by God. You do not belong to yourself, for God bought you at a high price, so you must honor God with your body. Your body, God chose to put his spirit in it. You're a temple. Do you know how much various cultures have spent building temples? There are some beautiful buildings out there. You're better. You're more beautiful. You're more valuable. You are the temple of God. Don't hate your body. Don't hate who you are. God doesn't. He designed it. He chose that for you. Take care of it. If you're a follower of Jesus, God lives in it. That's good news. David has this image of God, that he's the God of daily life, that he's the God of spiritual life, that he's also the source of the physical and spiritual world. And then David comes to this conclusion then in the final stanza, in the final verses. How do we respond to this God, he says. Now, let's be careful when we read it, starting verse 19. Oh God, if only you would destroy the wicked. Get out of my life, you murderers. They blaspheme you. Your enemies misuse your name. Let's keep one thing in mind in terms of context. David is the king of the promised land. When Israel moved into the promised land, they were told, tear down all the idols, remove the priests, destroy the nations that are sacrificing their babies and worshiping with temple prostitutes. Get rid of that in my land. But we do need to recognize that that command was not applied anywhere else. When anyone went into Egypt, God never told them to tear down temples and forcibly convert people. When they were going to be in captivity in Assyria and Babylon and Persia, many prophets had many messages. Not one prophet told them, when you get there, tear down temples, embarrass people, prove them wrong. Never once. As the church was going out, the church was sent into some terrible cities where all kinds of despicable things were going on. And what was the command of God? You go and live humbly before God. The command of God outside of this context in which David was responsible to get rid of these people, the command of God to all of us throughout history has been very simple. Two things. Live the truth and speak the truth. Live holy lives and preach the gospel. So, let's keep that in mind when we go back and look at David's anger and his frustration and his desire for destruction. Is there room for that in us? Yes, there still is, because we want truth. We don't like injustice. We don't like people being abused. We want to speak up and stand up for people that are caused to suffer because of other people's sin. Yes, there's room for that. We're not going to pray down lightning to kill people, but we are going to stand up for the truth. And why? Because we know God and we know his truth. You know, we know this God who's with us everywhere and is full of the spirit world because he gave us the spirit world and the physical world. We know him. We know what he thinks. And so we're going to stand by him. And we're going to speak the truth. When something is wrong in God's eyes, we're going to say, that's God wrong in God. It's not about me. It's God is hurt by that. So those things do apply to us. But as Jesus describes it for us, there's an amazing kind of balance again we have to strike here. In Matthew 10:16, Jesus says, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves, so be as shrewd as snakes, but as harmless as doves. Okay. As shrewd as snakes, but as harmless as doves. Sheep among the wolves. It's an amazing thing to think about, how we bring God's humility into an angry world. Love those that hate us, pray for those that persecute us. Jesus' bottom line was all full of that. We can understand David's frustration and his anger and his desire to get rid of all the enemies, but with a full revelation of Jesus, we know that God is actually doing that. He will get rid of all the enemies, and not because we defeat them. That's part of his plan. All we need to do is stay with him, honor him, love him, live holy lives, and preach the gospel. God doesn't need our help, but he wants us to help. We're like little kids running around with Daddy. Daddy, can I help you wash the car? Sure. that car's a mess when you're finished. Daddy, can I help you paint the fence? Sure. After you're tucked into bed, dad's out there cleaning up the mess, you know, repainting it. God wants us to be involved, but he doesn't need us. But we're his kids. He's our daddy. We get to be involved. And he loves us. But in David's humility, he then comes to the final statement at the end of all of this that is just amazing. What should we conclude from all this? When we understand that God is everywhere and throughout our lives, when we understand that his spirit is in charge of the entire spirit world and nothing happens without his willingness, when we realize that he is the source, he's the creator of all things, and that there's those who opposed it and he hates those that are opposed, where does this leave us? Search me, O God. Yeah, I get frustrated when people do that and with people that act like that. Oh God, search me. Don't let me get carried away. Search me and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. I think it's a really interesting phrasing there. Not just the angry thoughts, but the anxious thoughts. You know, a little child is with their parent, and the parent is saying, trust me. You know, just jump off the footstool, just trust me. And it seems like such a huge gap to that child. Well, you know, they're a child. They're made of rubber. They're not going to get hurt. Even if you drop them, they're just going to bounce back up. But it's all about trust. Trust me. And you say, oh, I don't think I can, Daddy. Trust me. It's kind of like you're hurting their feeling when you don't trust them. Being anxious about all things, we're just saying, Daddy, I don't trust you. Trust me. You know me. Look at all these places, all these things I've told you that I am already. Trust me. Search me, O God. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you. I don't want to just recognize the things in the world that offends God. I need to know the things in me that offend God. And I need God to lead me along the path of everlasting life. This is David's conclusion. I love it. This is an amazing conclusion. How personal it becomes. When he has grasped all these things, Micah 6:8 words it a little bit differently, but it's the same powerful image. Micah 6:8, he's shown you, O mortal. I love that. The New Living uses the word mortal. Most of our older translations, he has shown you, O man, what is. It's mortal, finite. You're not a great, powerful being. He's shown you, O limited one. What is good? What does the Lord require of you? Here is God's will for your life. Act justly. Love mercy. Walk humbly with God. And we see that in King David, despite everything else that he had to do and everything he went through. This describes David. And the end of Psalm 139, this is David's call for us. Remember David, he wanted that song to be sung in the temple. He wanted people to hear it. He wanted people to know how he had come to that conclusion that really what's important about his life is that he's humble before God. He knows God. He trusts God. He is in God's world. God is in him and he is humble before God. That's good news.